Muslims in Iran and other countries around the world celebrate Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. The death toll from Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip rises to 72, among them 17 children and 6 women. Also coming up, the Yemeni army says it has launched successful drone and missile attacks on several targets inside Saudi Arabia, including an Aramco oil facility. Thank you for joining us. Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. To mark the event, Muslims flock to mosques to offer congregational prayers. However, this year's mass prayers are cancelled in many countries due to the coronavirus pandemic. But in some countries, including Turkey and Indonesia, people perform the Eid prayers observing social distancing measures. Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds also attended the prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque despite tensions over Israel's deadly attacks in the occupied territories and the besieged the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian president has cancelled this year's celebrations to mourn the victims of Israeli raids on Gaza. Iranians also mark the occasion across the country. Thousands of worshippers attended Eid al-Fitr prayers at the shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam in the holy city of Mashhad. Iranians in the southwest province of Khuzestan also performed prayers. In the capital Tehran, people also offered Eid prayers. Eid al-Fitr is a major holiday in most Muslim-majority nations. In many countries, people wear new clothes and prepare special dishes to celebrate the occasion. They also pay visits to their relatives and friends. Now, the death toll from the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip reaches at least 72 as tensions run sky high between the two sides. 17 children and 6 women have been killed in the regime's raids since Monday. Several high-rise residential buildings collapsed in Gaza after Israeli warplanes targeted them in airstrikes. Several areas, including Gaza City, Jenin, and Gharara, were bombed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has slammed Tel Aviv, saying Israel's continued aggression against Palestinians shows the regime has no regard for international norms and conventions. He added that the Palestinian Authority will do all it can to defend the people. Palestine's Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya has also condemned the Israeli attacks.
The failure of Israel's plan in Jerusalem in the face of our people's steadfastness has pushed into a bloody aggression against the Gaza Strip. Israel is the aggressor and the occupying power that commits crimes against our people, and it bears full responsibility for that and for violating international law and international humanitarian law.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has retaliated against Israeli attacks by hitting Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv. The Israeli army says the group has fired around 1,500 rockets towards Israel since Monday. A fresh round of rocket barrage has caused the sirens to go off in northern Israel for the first time and prompted officials to divert flights from Ben Gurion Airport. The ongoing wave of violence broke out after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters across the West Bank amid escalating tensions in the occupied territories. In Ramallah, Israeli troops fired tear gas to disperse the Palestinian protesters who hurled rocks and started fires. One Palestinian was killed in the scuffles there. Similar attacks happened in Nablus and several other cities across the occupied land. A Palestinian man was killed in South Nablus after he reportedly opened fire at Israeli forces. That raised the number of Palestinians killed in the occupied West Bank to at least 5. In another incident, Israeli settlers attacked a Palestinian driver in a Tel Aviv suburb and severely beat him. The The unrest comes as Israel is pushing ahead with a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinians in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Let's cross over to the occupied territories and Ramallah, joined there by Muna Kandil, to get an idea of the latest situation on the ground there as tensions escalate. Muna, what's the latest?
Last night, protesters in several areas of the occupied West Bank, Palestinians took part in demonstrations, marching towards areas where Israeli checkpoints were located, in Tul Karim, in Qalqilia, in Nablus, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, as well as in the occupied city of Ramallah. Of course, Israeli forces at these checkpoints fired heavy tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. In every protest, a number of Palestinians were wounded. Maybe the highest number of Palestinians were wounded in the occupied West Bank was in Nablus, with over 55 Palestinians were injured by the Israeli army fire. This morning, and it's the first day of Eid al-Fitr, al-Fitr holiday following the month of Ramadan, at least 100,000 Palestinians succeeded to perform the prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, despite the strict measures there, and despite that Israeli settlers were on the main roads preventing Palestinian vehicles to reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they were throwing stones and rocks at the Palestinian vehicles on the main streets leading to the holy city of Jerusalem. Al-Quds, however, the number was 100,000 Palestinian worshippers succeeded to perform the prayers. In Kfar Qasim, one of the Palestinian cities that were occupied in 1948, Palestinians, following the Fajr prayers and Eid al-Fitr prayers, they marched there to express their anger against the crimes being committed in the Gaza Strip and the force being used by the Israeli forces in the Arab and Palestinian towns occupied in 1948. They burnt a number of police vehicles. However, in Silwan, in Al-Quds this morning, the settlers attacked the Palestinian homes, as well as in Al-Mghayyar, northeast Ramallah. This area is very close to a number of illegal settlements. Clashes have erupted between the settlers and the Palestinians, and a number of people were arrested by the Israeli forces.
And Muna, we've got the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, saying that the attacks on the besieged of the Gaza Strip will continue until a long-term quiet occurs or before any truce. But at the same time, we've got the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip launching rockets that have reached Tel Aviv, that have disrupted Ben Gurion Airport, that have hit vital Israeli infrastructure, missiles that have been used, you know, tactically. You've got 130 missiles being fired in a matter of minutes, missiles that we haven't seen before. How long, do we have any idea how long perhaps Israel can resist, can, you know, resist this kind of situation with these waves of attacks from the besieged Gaza Strip?
That's right. The Israeli military of the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said that the military operation will continue in the Gaza Strip for a long time as necessary, and there is currently no end in the sight. He said that Israel is preparing, is not preparing for a ceasefire, and there is currently no end date for the operation. Only when the Israeli military achieve complete quiet, then they can talk about calm. So they are insisting that the Palestinians should stop the rockets being fired from the Gaza Strip. Then Israel would see if it will be ending its operation. Otherwise, they will continue. But at the same time, this time the Palestinian rockets are causing disastrous consequences on the ground for Israel, of course, because it's not only Palestinian rockets being fired in open areas in Israel. However, these rockets had been hitting Israeli buildings and vehicles. There is a number of casualties. Maybe it's the highest number this time for the first time, with a number of Israelis were killed, dozens of others were wounded, tens of thousands of Israelis are entering the shelters. They are afraid. There is no schools. The situation have completely changed. And at the same time, what the Israelis are facing today is also this anger in the Palestinian and Arab areas occupied in 1948 in support of the resistance and to denounce the Israeli crimes being committed against the Gaza Strip.
Okay, we'll see how long Israel can cope with this changing equation, as you alluded to. Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there, our correspondent, joining us from the occupied territories, Ramallah. Now, Iranians have held a protest rally in solidarity with Palestinians amid the recent escalation of Israeli violence and the regime's brutal attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. The protesters rallied in the capital, Tehran, following Eid al-Fitr prayers. They denounced the Israeli aggression and called for the liberation of Palestine. The people in Syria also expressed their support for Palestinians by taking to the streets in the capital, Damascus, chanting slogans against the Israeli regime. A series of protests were also held in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where demonstrators offered their support to the Palestinians. In South Africa's Cape Town, similar rallies were held. People also hit the streets in different European capitals, including London and Vienna, to demand an end to the Israeli onslaught against the Palestinians.
In London, thousands hit the streets, furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they do. They buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating, deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Soudan, London.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out fresh drone and missile attacks against key targets inside Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says Saudi Arabia's state-owned Aramco oil facility and locations in the city of Najran, including its airport, were hit with 12 missiles and drones. He said Qasr 2K drones and the Badr Qasr missiles were used in the attacks and accurately hit their targets. The Yemeni army says such operations are in response to Saudi Arabia's continued war and siege on the impoverished nation. The kingdom and its allies launched their war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. The third day of registration for potential candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential election is underway. The registration is taking place at the headquarters of the Interior Ministry in Tehran. Several prominent figures, including former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, former Defense Minister Hossein Dahghan and Saeed Mohammed, who formerly served as commander of a major construction base, have already registered. The presidential hopefuls have until Saturday to turn up at the venue and hand in their credentials. When the registrations are over, the documents will be delivered to the Constitutional Council, which is in charge of examining the credentials and deciding which hopefuls are competent enough to run for president. The vetting body will release a final list of approved presidential candidates on May the 26th till the 27th. 2021 election is slated for June the 18th. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The first efforts to eradicate malaria began in 1950s under the World Health Organization's Global Malaria Eradication Program, one that decided to leave sub-Saharan Africa out of the global campaign, making use of the anti-malarial drug chloroquine and spraying large areas with insecticide DDT. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Michael Jennings under the heading, Support for New Malaria Vaccine May Be Lacking in Rich World. This article was provided by Syndication Bureau. Please stay tuned to hear more. Lost in the deluge of news about COVID-19 vaccines have been the momentous strides made recently in fighting other major health challenges. Among these is malaria. Michael Jennings wrote in April it was announced that a vaccine developed at the University of Oxford Jenner Institute had achieved 77% efficacy in trials. While we may still be several years from an effective guard against a disease that afflicts more than 200 million people each year, there is a sense that we are significantly closer to that goal than ever before. Yet the vaccine's very potential to eradicate malaria could perversely undercut the support necessary to achieve reality. Malaria is an example of where the needs of the global south or developing world clash against the interest of the global north or developed world. First, a caveat. It must be noted that the vaccine trial in Burkina Faso was small, involving 450 children over 1 year in an area where malaria is not present year-round. Longer-term monitoring and larger trials are the next stage in confirming these early results. But the findings thus far offer a tantalizing glimpse of real possibilities. Malaria is a parasite transmitted by the anopheles mosquito feeding on human blood, which can lead to fever, severe anemia, and severe damage to organs. With some types of malaria, the disease attacks brain function. Around 95% of cases and deaths are in Africa. Children under age 5 account for around 2/3 of the 400,000 yearly deaths around the world. However, malaria historically is not a disease confined to the global south. The disease's very name, Italian literally bad air, highlights the extent of its historical presence in Europe. It was endemic in the UK and the Netherlands into the 20th century, and Italy was not declared malaria-free until 1970. The first efforts to eradicate malaria began in 1950s under the World Health Organization's Global Malaria Eradication Program, one that decided to leave sub-Saharan Africa out of the global campaign. Making use of the anti-malarial drug chloroquine and spraying large areas with the insecticide DDT. Attention on malaria revived in late 1990s with the creation of Rollback Malaria Campaign. And the focus on the disease as one of the big three global health challenges in the UN's Millennium Development Goals. And as the main focus of organizations like the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Through the distribution of insecticide treatment bed nets, the development of new drugs to treat malaria, and renewed effort to control mosquito populations, malaria deaths have halved over the past two decades. And the new Oxford vaccine offers the possibility of cutting death significantly, perhaps to the low tens of thousands within a few years of a successful vaccine being rolled out. But caution is still required. First, what is clear from the history of malaria control and the global response to health challenges over the past half century is that successful health programs require sustained and focused attention and support. Progress against malaria made in places like Sri Lanka and elsewhere by the 1970s was subsequently undone as global funding for control efforts fell. And, as strange as it may seem, success sometimes can pave the way to failure. The renewed focus two decades ago on malaria alongside the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, and tuberculosis in the MDGs and in international organizations were not just a reflection of the terrible toll these diseases have taken in the global south, and especially Africa, but a recognition that they posed threats to the health security of the global north too. Scientists in Oxford and elsewhere have worked for years on finding a malaria vaccine. But the vaccine's emergence and the support for such research from public funds tells us something important about global health. Rapid advances in medicine are often linked to the perception of a health issue as presenting a health security challenge to the global north. Growing fears that the climate emergency will create conditions in which endemic malaria could re-emerge or spread to new locations in the global north have underscored some of the focus on malaria as a global health priority, just as the declaration of the 2013 to 2016 Ebola epidemic as a global health emergency was promoted in part by the recognition that the capitals of Europe and North America were at risk, thanks to the proximity created by the air travel. Meanwhile, the so-called neglected tropical diseases, a collection of 17 diseases that primarily affect the bottom billion of the world's population with limited threat to residents or even tourists of the global north, remain poorly funded in comparison with the numbers affected. Michael Jennings said, if a successful vaccine could limit infections and deaths and reduce the perceived threat to the health security of the global north, malaria could very easily find itself relegated to the lower ranks of health priorities, and we might subsequently find it harder to mobilize the funding required to achieve eradication. Would the UK have reduced its funding for the polio eradication campaign by 95% if that disease continued to pose a serious risk to Britain? Jennings added, second, we have been here before with the promises of a new silver bullet. Hopeful candidates for a successful vaccine have emerged over the past couple of decades only to fail the critical test of exposure to large-scale testing. Still, this new vaccine looks to have more promise than earlier iterations. But even if it works, it will primarily be a tool for controlling, not eliminating, malaria. The news is then to be welcomed, but cautiously. A dramatic cut in death would be very welcome and might create the potential for a successful eradication campaign. But even if it does show 77% effectiveness in real-life context, eradication is likely to be measured still in decades rather than years, and that's if financial altruism to support the vaccine can be maintained in the global north.
Debate.
The most intense hostilities in 7 years. At least 60 Palestinians killed in Gaza, including 5 women and 16 children, as of now. And 6 in Israel, including an Israeli soldier. Israel is attacking the Gaza Strip with the same aggression it attacked Palestinians in Jerusalem outlets. Palestinians' only rescue card, the Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas from the Gaza Strip, who have penetrated Israel's U.S. paid Iron Dome missile defense system. Stay tuned to another edition of the debate. Let me introduce our guests for this debate. We have Charlotte Cates, international coordinator at Samadun, who joins us from Vancouver. Welcome, and we also have Robert Fantino, who's an author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. So, Charlotte Case, let me first start with you and get your reaction. The most intense hostilities in 7 years, as I mentioned, you have about 60 Palestinians killed, 5 women, 16 children, and then on the Israeli side, you have 6, including an Israeli soldier.
These attacks that are taking place on Palestine are attacks that are not just taking place at the hands of the United States. We have to be at the hands of Israel. We need to be very clear that the United States and every other country that is continues to justify and support the Zionist settler colonial project in Palestine is fully complicit in the crimes taking place, is fully complicit in the forced evictions in Sheikh Jarrah that are being attempted, is fully complicit in the attacks on Al-Aqsa, is fully complicit in the attacks on Gaza. The crimes and crimes against humanity that are being inflicted upon the Palestinian people, you know, did not just start this week, have been continuing for 73 years. This week also marks the anniversary of the Nakba, in which we know that for 73 years, Palestinians have been struggling to live in their homelands, reclaim their rights, to return and to liberate their land from a settler colonial occupation that is based on dispossession, destruction, and devastation of the land and people of Palestine. And this week makes it incredibly clear that international action is critical to support the Palestinian people and stand with their brave resistance in this very important moment and crisis of conscience for the world.
Bert Fantina, Israel has been holding aerial raids at this point, even prior to us coming on air, onto the Gaza Strip, which basically has about 2 million in terms of its population, and it's 362 square kilometers, ranking it as the third most densely populated place in the world. So basically, if you drop a bomb, you're sure to kill people. That's one point that I'd like to get your reaction on. And second, a simple question that perhaps many are not asking, whether it's through the media or elsewhere. Why is Israel killing Palestinians right now?
Well, in response to your first question, yes, Israel knows very well that the bombs that it drops are going to be extremely destructive. There are going to be many, many casualties. But that's in keeping with Israeli government policy, which sees Israelis and Israeli Jews only as superior and everyone else as inferior, especially Palestinians. So by killing more of them, by bombing the Gaza Strip, this is in keeping with their policies of genocide and ethnic cleansing. So that's a main issue there. The reason for the current onslaught is, again, started by Israel, and as your other commentator said, many other nations of the world are complicit. During Ramadan, the sacred month, many Palestinians were deprived of their religious right to go and pray and worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Israeli settlers and soldiers entered the mosque, set off stun guns, gas guns. They assaulted people who were praying and worshiping completely unprovoked. And this led to resistance by Palestinians in Jerusalem. This has expanded as Hamas and the government in the Gaza Strip has decided to retaliate against these criminal activities, these criminal actions. So, as always, the U.S., supported by the United States and with weaponry provided by the United States, is now massacring Palestinians in Gaza. This will continue for some time. It's tragic, and the international community must step up to stop it.
Well, let's take a look at what U.S. Politicians have said on this, and if I may address this to you, Charlotte Gates. Looking at, let me take a pick here. Okay, I'm going to ask you about what the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, has said, imploring on Israel to avoid civilian deaths, and this is while he was defending Israel's right to attack Gaza. And he said, quote, "I think Israel has an extra burden in trying to do everything they possibly can to avoid civilian casualties, even as it is rightfully responding in the defense of its people." And he said the images of dead Palestinian children are harrowing. Correct me if I'm wrong, Charlotte Case, but isn't the U.S. providing Israel with some of those jets that is bombing Gaza?
Absolutely. I mean, Israel is funded, armed by the United States. The United States gives Israel over $3.8 billion in aid each year, and that aid is all directed specifically toward arming the Israeli military that is responsible for these atrocities taking place against Palestinians. If Blinken and the U.S. government were actually concerned about the lives of Palestinians, about the rights of Palestinians to their homes and lands and lives, then they would cut U.S. aid to Israel. They would stop this aid. But instead, the United States has resisted even The mildest attempts to condition that aid. There have been attempts by members of Congress to introduce legislation to put some conditions on U.S. aid to Israel in terms of its use in support of illegal settlements or its use in, specifically in the targeting and imprisonment of children. And even this has been rejected. And so what, you know, any kind of stated concern about Palestinian lives while continuing to arm and fund and even block international action in the United Nations Security Council on the part of the U.S. government just really reveals their hypocrisy in this regard. The reality is that it's Palestinians who have the right to resist. Palestinians are an occupied people, and under international law, including as recognized by UN resolutions, occupied people and people fighting colonialism have a right to resist and seek their liberation by all means necessary, including explicitly armed struggle. And so it's in fact Israel that has no right to engage in such military attacks, because the whole purpose of such attacks is defending an illegitimate occupation that is based on a racist ideology of Zionism and settler colonialism and targeting of the Palestinian people. So in fact, the situation is entirely backwards from the way that Blinken has portrayed it. But of course, the United States does not want to see itself held responsible for its war crimes and crimes against humanity, not only being conducted in Palestine, but in Iraq and throughout the region.
Robert Fantina, let's look at some of the statements coming from Israeli officials. Israel's Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, he vowed war attacks on Hamas and other groups in Gaza. He said to bring total long-term quiet before considering a ceasefire. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, quote, this is just the beginning. We will deliver them blows that they have not dreamt of. Now, when you hear that, doesn't it sound like they're thirsty for Palestinian blood?
Absolutely. They want Palestinians to die. As I mentioned before, it is a genocidal regime, Israel is, and they want to destroy all the Palestinians. They've been doing that for over 70 years now, killing them, driving them out of Palestine, driving them into refugee camps. They are happy to be killing Palestinians. We remember from 2014, during that onslaught, we saw Israeli Zionists cheering as bombs were dropping on Gaza. This is absolutely unspeakable. It's so inhumane. But the leaders of Israel are leading that charge and leading those cheers, and are motivating their people to more bloodthirsty activities. It's interesting to note also that this is perhaps a distraction from Netanyahu's many problems. There are riots going on throughout Israel as Arabs and and Israelis are clashing in the streets. Netanyahu is, of course, being tried on corruption charges. He's been unable to establish a government. There is great disarray in Israel, and bombing Gaza is something many Zionists, not all Israelis certainly, but all Zionists get behind, and that is his base. That is who he wants to please. And if he can distract them from the internal problems by these bloodthirsty statements and actions, then he will do so.
Well, there's a problem over here, Charlotte Gates, that we're almost looking like a copycat scenario. I mean, it's not like the first time we're looking at this at a war between. Of course, the media is refraining from saying this is a war, but it's not the first time we're seeing this unfold. We've seen three of them, and you know, you have the usual scenario almost playing out each and every time. And it really goes beyond this now. And my question to you is, what can be done? I mean, at this point, it's the third day. You've had these statements coming from Israeli officials that, there's going to be quiet there, and we're going to do something to you that you've never dreamed of. Sounds like there's going to be more deaths. What can be done? And of course, the UN Security Council emergency sessions, Arab League emergency sessions, or the Arab countries, I'm putting a whole lot on a plate here. None of that panned out in the previous wars, and here we are again.
Absolutely. I mean, just to be clear, one thing that has really emerged in the current situation that has made itself extremely clear is the unity of the Palestinian people throughout occupied Palestine, from the river to the sea. And so it's very important to note that Palestinians in Gaza are not alone and separated, despite all of the siege and the walls and the occupation that has been imposed on Palestine for the past 73 years. Palestinians in Gaza are not alone. This is taking place in clear connection to a struggle that is happening in Jerusalem to fight back against land confiscation and home demolitions and the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem. And inside occupied Palestine 48, in Alid, in Ramla, in Haifa, in Nasra, Palestinians en masse are taking to the streets and are fighting back by all means against the occupation that has occupied their land since 1948. So it's exposing the lie of, you know, quote unquote, equality inside settler colonial Israel when there has never been such equality. And the entire state is based on the rejection of Palestinian existence and identity. So the unity of the Palestinian people throughout occupied Palestine, but also in exile and diaspora, is very clear. I mean, just yesterday, there were over 5,000 people filling the streets of New York. There were 1,000 people in Berlin this weekend. There are, at our website, samidun.net, we maintain a resource of international events, and there are just dozens and dozens of protests and actions and demonstrations led by the Palestinian community outside Palestine and also by international supporters of justice and dignity for the Palestinian people that are taking place everywhere around the world. And so it's so important that we stand with and support the Palestinian resistance, because we know that it is the Palestinian people and their resistance that are going to make the difference, that are going to be able to liberate Palestine. And it's the actions of the resistance and the people that are going to be the things that push the UN Security Council or the Arab League to actually do something instead of just issuing empty statements or being blocked by the United States' veto. And so that's why it's so important that we take action to try to fight back against complicity however we can. So that means taking the streets, going to demonstrations, making it impossible to conduct business as usual so long as the Israeli violence and settler colonialism against the Palestinian people continues, and also by building the boycott movement against Israel. Because, you know, and that includes sanctions on Israel, that includes a military embargo, that includes stopping this endless flow of aid and military support to the Zionist occupation that is taking Palestinian lives. By popular mobilization of the people of the world, we can fight back to change what our governments are doing by making it not possible to keep on the same path of continuing the destruction of Palestinians. And that's how we can support the most important and necessary thing, which is what the Palestinian people and their resistance are doing on the ground to struggle for liberation.
Well, you talk about the boycott of Israeli goods, and perhaps the BDS issue or topic should come into the picture over here, Robert Fantina. And let me direct that topic through the EU lens. The EU has come out saying that Israelis and Palestinians have to immediately stop and halt their violence in order to prevent a broader conflict that will impact civilian populations. That's what the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, issued as a warning, which I think is a little bit late for that. I mean, the EU comes out saying it's dismayed at the large number of civilian deaths and injuries. EU always comes out making statements regarding the Israeli violations. The EU is Israel's largest trading partner. Doesn't that give EU a leverage over Israel in that respect, that it can do something to prevent Israel from carrying out these airstrikes, and hence the BDS notion can come into that?
It definitely gives the EU leverage that the EU refuses to use. It's the same with the United States. The United States could end the occupation today by cutting all aid to Israel and sanctioning it. And the United States government is not hesitant to sanction nations that displease it. So it could certainly do the same with Israel, as the EU could also. But they, as you mentioned, it's Israel's largest trading partner. They like the trade, they like the profits, and they are willing to overlook these atrocious human rights violations, these crimes against humanity, these continued violations of international law, so that the profits will keep on streaming in. This is one of the problems that are one of the issues that's similar in the United States. It's not so much the profits, that's part of it, but it's the pro-Israel lobbies that donate so much money to elected officials and then write legislation for those officials to introduce and vote on. But it's not only the EU and the United States, but all countries that deal with Israel can issue sanctions, they can reduce trade, there are many steps they can take, many diplomatic steps they can take. The EU is talking about a possible escalation of the so-called war between Israel and Palestine. Israel has one of the most powerful countries in the world, backed by the most powerful. Palestine has no army, navy, or air force. The Gaza is blockaded. The West Bank, Jerusalem are fully occupied. This is not an equal war. This is simply a slaughter by one powerful nation and the brave and courageous resistance by its victim nation.
Yeah, but at the same time, Charlotte Gates, we're looking at how the Gaza resistance fighters have launched, from different factions, have launched more than 1,000 rockets to Israel. I mean, we are looking at the retaliatory attacks coming through these rockets that's being fired towards Israeli cities. The Iron Dome system of Israel has failed to intercept all of these rockets, which may indicate that these rockets are somewhat more advanced than previous times. And what's worse is that we have reports that 15 of these rockets were actually headed towards Dimona, which is Israel's nuclear reactor is. So we can see how this is getting out of hand. I'm guessing if I was Israel and its officials, that it would recalculate the war strategy here, given the fact that you're looking at all these rockets coming and some to have hit Tel Aviv.
I mean, clearly the resistance is engaging in these kind of deterrent attacks in order to protect the Palestinian people, in order to provide a form of protection that has been denied Palestinians for not only 73 years of Nakba, but 100 years of colonialism. And so that is the purpose of the Palestinian resistance, you know, first and foremost, is to protect and defend the Palestinian people. Now, the Israeli regime has been dedicated to attempting to kind of wipe out all forms of Palestinian resistance for, again, over 73 years. And what it must come to terms with is that it is not possible to do that. And just like it is not possible to erase the Palestinian people from this land, it is not possible to erase the Palestinian identity from this land, and it is not possible to stop a people from defending themselves and protecting themselves against a massive military machine that is backed by the most powerful military machine in the world. And so, yes, it is 100% true that the Israeli state and the Zionist regime is completely responsible for every single death and injury that may befall any Israeli citizen or soldier. They are responsible for this by continuing this ongoing policy of ethnic cleansing, mass bombing, siege, denial of the right to return, mass incarceration, home demolitions, land confiscation, and destruction of the Palestinian people. And so, every single Israeli casualty is the responsibility of the Israeli state, is the responsibility of Zionist war policies, is the responsibility of those war crimes. And so it is the blood of those Israelis is on the hands of Netanyahu and the fascist Israeli leadership. The Palestinian resistance are defending their people against occupation and oppression.
Final question, Robert Fantina. Obviously, there are core issues in terms of the conflict between Israel and Palestinians that need to be resolved. That is a given. There is no peace process at this point going on. That so-called deal of the century, I think, is dead. It was dead to begin with, based on many analysts, in terms of how Trump came out with that. So how can we move towards that? What will be the catalyst to put these two in any type of a peace motion so that what we're looking at now does not happen?
What's required, again, is adherence to international law, which Israel refuses to do. That's why the other countries in the world must sanction and boycott Israel until Israel adheres to international law and removes the almost 600,000 illegal settlers, ends all the checkpoints, ends the blockade, and retreats to its UN-established borders. Now, we can talk about if those borders are legitimate, but that's another issue. But for now, Israel negotiations are meaningless. They're unimportant. Negotiations are impossible when between two nations, when one can take whatever it wants with complete impunity and is not willing to give up anything. So those negotiations went on for years with no progress for the Palestinians. They're nonsense. They should not be restarted. What has to happen is that the people around the world need to force their governments to force Israel to adhere to international law. That's why it's important for people who are fighting for Kashmiri rights. That's why it's important for people who are supporting Black Lives Matter movement in the United States and the people who are the pro-Palestinian people around the world to join forces to bring justice to the beleaguered people who are victimized by powerful nations that are willing to overlook their rights in the name of power and profits. So it will be has to be a people's movement. We have seen the governments themselves not take action. The people must take actions to force their governments to do the right thing.
Great. Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Robert Fantino, we appreciate your input here. Author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario. Charlotte Cates, thank you. International coordinator let me make sure I pronounce this properly, Samidoun from Vancouver. Thank you so much for your contribution. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
Back to reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Back to Reality with myself, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. And joining me today is my beloved brother, Brother Sayyid Ayman. Welcome to the program, brother.
Thank you very much, brother.
Today, we'll be speaking about Eid and what Eid means and what do people do for Eid. You lived in two different places. Like, obviously, you were in Pakistan for a while, a Muslim majority yes. country, and then obviously you moved to another place. The differences you felt between the two Eids and so on. You might be, I think, before we get to that, what is Eid for you? Coming to the end of the blessed month of Ramadan, how Eid should make you feel and how people actually do feel?
Basically, I think if I look back, you know, over my life, you know, I think there were stages that, you know, when I was young, maybe I had no idea of, you know, the true idea of Eid. Maybe it was just about having fun and, you know, just attending parties or, you know, participating in festivities, eating, you know, buying new clothes and all that. But I think, you know, as time has passed and, you know, we have grown up and we have mm-hmm. learned a little bit more about Ramadan, you know, it's just very nice to know that when you spend a whole month in sacrificing, mm-hmm. you know, having those feelings for yourself, you start to feel about others, that how others are feeling, mm-hmm. you know, when they're hungry, for example, or when they don't have food, or when they don't have clothes. So, I mean, this notion, usually makes you responsible in a way that when Eid comes, nowadays, you know, I try my best. I feel more happy when I am, you know, sharing with others. So it's, you know, it's different for me now. But still, you know, according to the hadith, you know, they are, a man should be very generous on the time of Eid, even to his family, spending money on clothing and food and all that. So what about you? What do you think?
Like, same like when we were younger, especially, you know, coming from that same subcontinental background, you know, I'm sure you had this, you would go to the elders' houses, right? You'd visit your aunt or your great aunt.
Yes.
And you would go in there with the expectation that, oh, I'm going to get Eid, right? You wait for the packet to come out, and you say, okay, here comes the packet, you know?
Oh, yes.
You get that small
amount. I still have that feeling. Even though I'm not so hopeful.
Yeah, exactly. So you remember that you would get, like, especially from your granny, your grandma.
Exactly.
Your grandma would be the best one to give you. Yeah. She'll always give you. Alhamdulillah, my late grandmother, I remember. May Allah have mercy on her. Even when I was studying in the UK, on Eid day, she would still give my Eid to my mom, and so she was just to keep it there. So it was just a good tradition.
Yeah.
So exactly, like, you would go to and you would like to meet family members you haven't seen for a long time, and we have that tradition in the subcontinent. You would go and visit, right?
Yes.
You would visit families. You would visit the elders' homes.
I remember as a child, you know, we used to wait for Eid.
Exactly.
Just in order to fill our pockets with loads of money, you know.
Money, and then blow it somewhere. And you wake, like your family would make a special type of suite as well. You go to that specific house for that specific suite.
Exactly.
So that was Eid as a youngster and stuff. And as you said, yeah, as we got older, we realized that, no, it's actually a sad time. For me personally, because it's coming to an end of a very sacred time.
Yes.
The holy month is a very specific, sacred, blessed time. The day, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made it forbidden to us to fast on Eid. And we're not allowed to fast on Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Adha. Because this is the rule that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made it, that you can fast any other day.
Yes.
You know, fasting is good for you. But on these 2 days, it's haram. You're not allowed to fast. It's a day for you to enjoy the blessings that I have given you.
I think, you know, for our listeners, you know, it would be a great idea if we really talk about the meaning of Eid, the word Eid, you know, itself, the literal meaning, and then maybe the spiritual aspect of it. Fitr has came from fatara, which is basically meaning breaking, right? And it's like breaking the fast. So, like, you have been fasting for the last 30 days, and now it's the day that you can't fast. You know, you're not allowed to fast, and you have to break your fast. So it's basically a feast, a day of feast, a day of celebration. And there is a spiritual aspect to it. I think you should talk about that.
For example, the word Eid. The word Eid comes from the word Aud. Aud means to return.
Yes.
Right? Awada. So awada means to return or to do something again. So one of the possible things that we as human beings on the day of Eid, especially when we, the salah that we pray and the dua that we pray, you know, that this day is an Eid specifically for a group of people. لِلْمُسْلِمِينَ عِيدًا وَلِلْمُحَمَّدٍ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَعَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمُ It's a day that is an Eid for an individuals who have set their lives and who set their steps as the steps of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. For those individuals who have returned back to their fitrah, they're going back to what is a fitrah? That your fitrah, or that
pure, the purity.
Your purity, that fitrah, that you've now, this is a true Nowruz. Eid al-Fitr is supposed to be a way, that a true Nowruz.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Nowruz. A true Nowruz.
Yeah.
Where you have, I don't know what you want to put, you have reawakened, or you have starting afresh again.
Yeah.
So as we know, I'm sure many of the other people have said this before, that according to the mystics, like in the book Iqbal al-A'mal, which most of our A'mal and du'as that we read in this month came from Iqbal al-A'mal of Sayyidina Tawus, he begins the book with the A'mal of Shahr Ramadan.
Yes.
And the reason that some of the insightful scholars and the mystics have said that why Ibn Tawus did that is because he sees Shahr Ramadan as the beginning of the year. The beginning of a Muslim's year is Shahr Ramadan. Because why? A Muslim is more focused on his spiritual aspect, his relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Hence, when Eid comes, it is a day where, okay, I have done this holy month in the 2 months before it as well, Rajab and Sha'ban. So these 3 months ending and coming to the peak in the holy nights of Qadr. When Eid comes, I can actually celebrate that I have achieved something.
Wow.
So Eid is actually a celebration only for that person who has able to return.
Return back to the purity.
Purity, back to the path, and who is able, even a person who truly